Welcome to a series of netcasts brought to you by Yale University.
Hello, and welcome to the Yale Law Journal podcast. I'm Aurelia Chaudhary.
And I'm Tyler Hill.
The topic of today's episode is class action lawsuits.
Class action lawsuits are usually brought by lawyers and a so-called representative plaintiff purporting to represent a class of thousands or even millions of other plaintiffs. How much should the lawyers have to know about those other plaintiffs in order to bring the lawsuit in the first place?
To discuss this issue of ascertainability, we have Jeff Shaw, a 2016 JD candidate here at the Yale Law School, to talk about his paper on the topic. Jeff, why don't you introduce us to your paper and the topic of ascertainability in general?
Class action lawsuits, in particular consumer class actions, serve an important regulatory function in American society. It's often only by aggregating claims of unknown parties that the lawsuit is able to adequately put pressure on corporations to conform to the law. And one of the main features of these classes is that it's often unclear who exactly is a member of the class. And so in the last 15 or so years, there have been a number of cases in which defendants have said, you can't go forward as a class action because there's not clear proof of exactly who or who is not a member of this class. This is really problematic for consumer class actions because it means that many of them would be almost impossible to bring. Not very many people keep receipts for their purchases. Many times businesses or stores don't keep affirmative records of who purchased what and when. And so if there's a strong ascertainability requirement in class action law, it's unlikely that consumer class actions would be able to achieve the same regulatory effects.
So why don't you walk us through ascertainability through a concrete example? I know your note makes reference to the case of Carrera versus Bayer. Can you maybe walk us through that case and how ascertainability was implicated there?
Sure. So in this case, a group of plaintiffs sued Bayer, which is a large pharmaceutical company, claiming that a weight loss supplement that they had purchased from CVS and other stores like that didn't work. And they tried to certify as a class. If they didn't have the class action available, it's likely that nobody would have brought an individual suit because, as Judge Posner said recently, only a zealot or a maniac sues for such a small amount of money. And Bayer said, you can't certify the class because you can't prove who is and who is not a member. The district court certified the class, didn't really apply an ascertainability test, but then the Third Circuit decertified the class. And so this is an example of controversial ascertainability case. It's been much discussed throughout the country. Some district courts have followed this type of analysis, rigorously scrutinizing the available methods of ascertaining class membership. Other courts have been a little bit more skeptical. My basic approach is to say, what are the justifications for including an ascertainability requirement in Rule 23?
Rule 23 being the rule governing class action certification, right?
That's right. And so I look at the different reasons why we might want to have an ascertainability requirement, and I find them unpersuasive. First, it's not necessary for the efficient functioning of class actions. And second, it's contrary to the purposes of Rule 23, which was to include the claims of people whose identity you don't know. The whole point of class actions is that you don't know who's in the class. That's what makes it different from individual suits and different from joinder.
So why don't we go actually back to the history of Rule 23. Maybe that can inform its purpose. Maybe say more about this. I know the current Rule 23 was introduced in 1966. Maybe we could start from there.
Rule 23 was originally included in the federal rules when they were written, which was in the late 1930s, but then it was significantly revised in 1966. This was because a number of academics and lawyers and drafters thought that Rule 23 as it existed was doing an inadequate job at bringing claims into court, and as a result was falling short on the kind of regulatory objectives that they had hoped aggregation would achieve. So the 1966 amendments specified quite a detailed set of criteria that a class needs to satisfy if it can go forward as a class action. These were designed to both enhance the opportunities for lawsuits, but also to restrict problematic class suits and protect the rights of defendants.
So this is a device originally used, let's just clarify, it's not just these consumer cases, right? I mean...
No, it's for a wide variety of cases. Consumer cases are one example, and one common example that the framers of Rule 23 had in mind. But class action lawsuits are also used for all kinds of things, employment law, constitutional rights, pretty much anything in which an injury applies to a group of people rather than one person.
With that background, let's maybe now return to Bayer. Let's imagine this class actually was certified and the lawsuit went forward and they found liability against Bayer. What would happen next? Would there be a newspaper advertisement? Would there be subsequent trials about who actually did and didn't purchase it? What would it look like?
Well, the first thing that the court would have to do if it certified the class is provide notice to the class members. In a 23B3 action, which is one of the subsets of class actions, the court has to direct the best notice practicable under the circumstances, and then to give members of the class the opportunity to opt out. The way that works is that they can use newspaper advertisements. They can put ads online. They can send things in the mail. The Constitution and Rule 23 requires notice reasonably calculated to reach the parties, not notice to each individual person. So the fact that the court doesn't know exactly who is a member of the class at that stage is not relevant to giving notice. Now, as your question asks, at the end of the case, the court has to figure out how it's going to disperse damages to individuals. And this process, in any action, whether it's a result of final judgment or a result of settlement, is likely going to be very chaotic, and it's going to involve individualized inquiry. This is true whether or not we want to have an ascertainability requirement. Normally, the way it works, and what would have happened in Carrera, is that the court would have established a claims process. They probably would have appointed an administrator, and then they would have again probably notified the class, and then class members or potential class members would have come out of the woodwork and made a claim to have a piece of the settlement. This is often an imperfect process. Sometimes not very many members of the class actually make a claim, but it's a manageable process in many situations. So I don't know if anybody that's listening has ever received an advertisement or receive something in the mail saying you might be a member of a class action, go to this website, type in your info, and then you can perhaps get a piece of the pie. That happens routinely, and the court can consider whether it is actually able to administer this claims process. The court can think about the actual difficulties involved in this and decide whether it would be manageable. Rule 23b3 specifically says the court can consider the manageability of a class action. But that's quite different from demanding that the class be ascertainable at the time of certification.
I thought it was very interesting that you brought up in your note the potential for remedies that weren't just payments to individual plaintiffs if the court thought that it was unlikely that the individual plaintiffs were likely to collect. And you brought up the alternatives of payments to a nonprofit organization that helped the kind of people who were injured by this lawsuit or other kinds of donations or penalties. Do you think that those end up being more likely in classes where the plaintiffs are not ascertainable because it's less likely that plaintiffs would come forward to collect?
I don't think that's necessarily the case. I think ascertainability speaks to the court's ability to identify the class members, whereas the way settlement works or damage payouts work, individuals have the responsibility to come forward of their own accord and make an affirmative case for class membership. So I think in many cases that we currently call unascertainable, the damages process would in fact be perfectly manageable, although that would of course be a decision for the courts to make. Now, it's true that the class action law does envision some remedies that never involve identifying individual class members at all. These are Cypre remedies, fluid recovery, and others. And I'm not suggesting that these are superior or beneficial remedies. There's a lot of controversy about them. The point I was trying to make by bringing these up is just that the idea that a class action has to be ascertainable in order to make remedies available at all isn't quite right. There are a lot of remedies that would be suitable even for classes that are so unascertainable that individual members would not be particularly forthcoming. Now, class actions have both a compensatory and a deterrent objective. One goal of these consumer class actions is to repay people who are harmed. Another goal is simply to enforce the law and deter future wrongdoing. The advantage of these remedies that don't involve payouts to individual class members is that they still achieve the deterrent function. So there's been, you know, everybody hates consumer class actions these days. There's a lot of skepticism about whether they in fact compensate class members and how much good they do on the compensation score, but they serve a vital deterrent and law enforcement purpose. By the way, it also doesn't necessarily thwart the compensatory objectives.
Right. So actually, let's go back through this. So you're saying that there are potential consequences of erecting these barriers to certification before a case is heard on the merits, because it's basically taking away the ability of the class action to serve this deterrence function. Maybe we can go through other discussions around the class action device that might implicate the same danger and put ascertainability into that context.
Well, there's many professors and commentators on civil procedure these days think that it's getting harder to bring class action lawsuits. Examples of procedural changes are the heightened pleading standards in Twombly and Iqbal that apply to all suits, including class actions, the Class Action Fairness Act, which puts many class actions into federal court rather than state court, and ascertainability as a requirement fits this general trend. It has the effect of making it harder to certify classes, which in turn makes it harder to bring class actions. So I see this requirement as part of a larger story. In principle, there's nothing wrong with an implicit requirement if it's really justified, but it's the responsibility of the ascertainability requirement to earn its own keep. I don't think those arguments are persuasive.
So one narrative around the broader set of criticisms about class actions, whether it's some of the heightened standards or around the Class Action Fairness Act, is a governance worry that the fact that plaintiffs are dispersed and don't necessarily have a lot of money at stake means that plaintiffs' attorneys end up running the show, and we might be worried about whether plaintiffs' attorneys really have the right incentives in bringing these class action lawsuits. You know, one example is that in the Class Action Fairness Act, there were additional restrictions placed upon what's called coupon settlement, where the damages paid to the class were essentially gift certificates issued by the defendant corporation. Plaintiffs' attorneys typically get 30% of the settlement, and so they got 30% of the nominal value of all of these coupons that were issued, but the plaintiffs largely didn't use any of the coupons, and so didn't actually get a lot of money. And this was sort of held up as a paradigmatic example of plaintiffs' attorneys getting paid out without actually accomplishing much on behalf of their clients, and showing that there is this significant governance problem in class actions. It seems like ascertainability might link to this governance problem in that there's even less of an opportunity for the actual clients, the plaintiffs themselves, to control their plaintiffs' attorneys if they can't know at the beginning of the case that they're potentially part of this case with as much certainty as they might if they were getting direct individualized mail.
Rule 23 contains procedural safeguards that try to make sure that the lawyers and the named plaintiffs are going to be acting in the best interests of the absent class members. And primarily that's Rule 23A's requirement that the named plaintiffs adequately represent the interests of the absent class members. So I think it's a real problem if lawyers are running the show at the expense of the interests of the absent class members. But I'm unconvinced that an ascertainability requirement is a particularly effective way of trying to ensure that interest. In many of these cases, if the class action device is not available, there is no alternative method of resolution that would be available to the plaintiffs because the economics of the situation counsel against individual suits and because joinder is not feasible. I would hope that courts would, instead of asking whether the class is ascertainable, would instead turn to the explicit requirements of Rule 23 and ask whether they can actually do their job and ask whether, if the class action doesn't go forward, there are really other ways of doing this.
So I'm going to push back, maybe returning to Ari's governance point. In a class action, the named plaintiff is basically exercising a right on behalf of all the people who are absent. And I guess there's a question whether, you know, if you can't point to the actual people who have the right, how are you going to exercise the right on behalf of those people?
The whole point of a class action is that you don't know exactly who is in the class. And the explicit requirements of Rule 23 ensure that there is a relationship between the named plaintiffs and the absent class members that enables them to adequately represent their interests. Rather than just requiring that the class be numerous, Rule 23 also requires that the class members have suffered a common injury. They require that the named plaintiffs have claims that are typical of the class as a whole, and they require that the named plaintiffs be able to adequately represent the class members. Further, the Supreme Court has reaffirmed time and again that district courts have to perform a rigorous analysis of these requirements, and they have to make sure that the rule is actively complied with. So I think the interests you raised are extremely important, but those are served through Rule 23's existing requirements.
Maybe it's a balance, right? There is an individual right belonging to the individual plaintiffs, but maybe there's this deterrence interest, and to the extent that they compete, we have to balance them. Is that what you're saying?
Right. Individuals have rights in litigation, But Rule 23 essentially exists to try to make sure that those rights are vindicated at all. It would be a bit ironic if you said, we're worried that your individual right is going to be compromised, so therefore you can't exercise anything like an individual right.
Right. So the consequence of taking the line that I've suggested to its natural conclusion is that the plaintiff has a right, but it's unexercisable.
Right. The idea behind aggregate litigation and behind Rule 23 is that if you're going to let plaintiffs exercise their rights, you have to provide an aggregation mechanism. And one of the consequences of having an aggregation mechanism, if it's going to be effective, is that you don't know the identities of individual class members.
Jeff, it seems like you lean pretty heavily on the other requirements of Rule 23, typicality, numerosity, but it seems like some of these might be harder to even judge in the absence of an ascertainable class. For example, it seems like it would be harder to know if the named plaintiff is typical of the class if you don't know very much about the whole set of class plaintiffs. So take, for example, the supplement. Maybe that particular plaintiff's motivation in taking the supplement was weight loss. Maybe other people took the supplement and knew that it didn't work, but were taking it for other reasons, for example. It just seems like some of these requirements assume that you know something about the class.
I think that's right, but that doesn't provide justification for an independent ascertainability requirement. That just says that ascertainability is often a noteworthy characteristic of certifiable classes. I don't think anybody disputes that. If a class is fully ascertainable, it's often the case that it does, in fact, satisfy the requirements of Rule 23. It's also often the case that it makes it easier to decide that they do. But that's slightly different from saying that it's an independent requirement on its own.
I want to continue to put this into a broader context of some of the hostility we've seen in the past towards class actions in Congress and in the courts. You could think about the deterrent function of class actions being played either by entrepreneurial plaintiff's lawyers going to court to enforce laws that are already on the books on behalf of their clients, or by the regulatory state stepping in, whether it's the FTC stepping in to ensure that claims about products are accurate, or the FDA choosing to regulate nutritional supplements more heavily. Do you think that ascertainable classes might be an example of an area where the regulatory state might be better suited than courts to solving this deterrent function?
I think that it's important for the regulatory state to partner with litigation to try to achieve compliance with the law across a wide variety of contexts. So I think the class action exists in the context of other forms of regulation. You know, one important alternative is A, direct regulation, but B, different forms of litigation. For example, parens patriae suits where a state AG or a city attorney can sue on behalf of a group of people that are within its charge. So I guess I don't see them as trading off against each other. I see them as partners in the process of enforcing the law. Class actions have an important role to play. If class actions roll back, perhaps other institutions and other forms of government can step up to the plate. But I think that that's slightly different from the question that I'm asking, which is, what does it really take for a class action to do its job? If the courts do continue to enforce a rigid ascertainability requirement, I think it will be important for other elements of the government to step up to the plate. So I would hope that the FTC would start taking on some of these cases. I would hope that there would be more parens patriae suits. But that's a little bit different from saying that this is a genuine class action malfunction.
So maybe take us around the context of this issue as it's playing out in the federal courts. I know Carrera was a Third Circuit case, but what other circuits have addressed this? How have they addressed it? And what do we think the future of the jurisprudence is going to look like?
Well, there's a great deal of uncertainty about this. Most of these cases are playing out in district courts. The Third Circuit, when it decertified the class in Carrera, had internal disagreement. There was a dissent from the denial of en banc review where Judge Ambrose said that he thought the Carrera decision carried the ascertainability requirement too far, even though he also agrees that an ascertainability requirement exists. In the Ninth Circuit, for example, the Central District and the Northern District are applying the requirement differently. There's even difference of opinion among judges on the same district court. And so the requirement has been applied in a haphazard fashion, and I think it remains to be seen whether clear circuit splits will emerge and whether the Supreme Court will feel the need to weigh in on this issue. I think that a far better situation is that we should go back to the text and fall back on lines of jurisprudence about how those textual provisions should be interpreted. There's a great deal to guide jurisprudence in that area that doesn't yet exist for the ascertainability requirement.
Maybe this is too conjectural, but how do you think the Supreme Court would address the issue? I know that some people say there's a general hostility in the court, as in the courts generally, toward the standards of bringing class action lawsuits. How do we think that would play?
Well, that might be. But on the other hand, I think there's an enthusiasm on the court for text coming from certain justices, and also an enthusiasm on the court for purpose coming from other justices. And so the way I've framed the ascertainability issue is that it frustrates the text of Rule 23 and it frustrates the purpose of Rule 23. So to the extent that some justices are textualists and other justices are purposivists, I know that's too simple a way of putting it, but to the extent that that's true, then perhaps they would be hostile to an ascertainability requirement.
Do you think it's worth the judicial conference looking at the actual Federal Rules of Civil Procedure and Rule 23 when it addresses, you know, how to redraft the rule?
Well, there has been some suggestion that ascertainability should be on the agenda of the Rules Committee if it looks at the rule again. And I think that if we really do decide as a society that the consumer class action has had its day, if we decide that it really is too important to be able to identify each individual class member, then that radical departure from the history of class actions should take place in the text of the rule for all the world to see. And that would be a suitable thing for the Rules Committee to do. I think that would be unfortunate as a policy choice. I think that would clash with the mission of class actions and render Rule 23 weaker than it is now. But I think that would be an institutional decision that would be more suitable for the Rules Committee than for individual district courts making certification decisions. It's better to have a change like that in written law than it is in the shadows of implication.
This concludes the second pilot episode of the Yale Law Journal podcast. In the episodes ahead, we look forward to offering you more insights and perspectives from our authors. Many thanks to Jack Beglin for the music, to Ryan McAvoy and the Yale Broadcast Center, and to the Yale Law Journal for its support.